Tom Hartman here with you in the second hour of our program today. William Eatman is going to drop by. He's a energy policy analyst with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Our question, which should we save? The polar bear or ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson's $16.7 million compensation package? In our third hour, Laurie Walters is going to drop by, talking about success in advertising. She's with Ironweed Films. And Christy Harvey, the Director of Strategic Communication with the Center for American Progress, will drop by with News Under the Radar. And also in our third hour, we're going to be talking about this whole situation with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and vice presidents and all that kind of stuff. Apparently, Obama has now officially put together a vice presidential search committee, selection committee. So we'll get into that conversation in the third hour of our program. And our quote for the day, by the way, from John Wilmot. He said, "Before I got married, I had six theories about bringing up children. Now I have six children and no theories." So our quote for the day, I can testify, only with three. Timothy Lee is with us. He's the Director of Legal and Public Affairs, the Center for Individual Freedom, CFIF.org is their website. And Timothy, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks a lot. I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you for being on. This morning when I read my local paper, there was this full-page ad in it. At the top it said, "I didn't get to vote today." And it talks about the Democrat who won the Democratic primary yesterday here in Oregon, mm-hmm. who will be going up against Gordon Smith, who is our Republican senator. And Gordon Smith, of course, a very strong anti-union voting record.
Right.
And it says, "Jeff Merkley won the Democratic primary Tuesday through a mailed private ballot by Oregon citizens. Yet he supports eliminating the right to a private vote when unions are enlisting new members. Hard to believe. Tell Merkley to support true democracy." And it's got the website for one of many of these organizations that have sprung up. I know many of them supported by the National Association of Manufacturers and other groups, some by conservative ideologues, who are basically suggesting that card check or the Employee Free Choice Act is somehow anti-democratic. And I know you've talked about this and blogged about this over at CFIF.org. What's the problem with the Employee Free Choice Act from your point of view?
Well, the first thing I'm going to say is anybody out there who disagrees with anything I say or thinks that I have some sort of ideological agenda behind it, look it up. Look up what I'm saying. This Employee Free Choice Act, first of all, that name is extremely deceptive. It's absolutely breathtaking in what it does. It does eliminate the secret ballot. What it does is says that in a union election, you know, say, for instance, you or I run a workplace and we have 100 employees and they are holding a vote as to whether or not they'll be unionized. Well, right now, you can insist upon a secret ballot. You go behind a closed booth, just like voting in any other election, and nobody has to know what your particular vote was. What card check would do, and the Employee Free Choice Act would do, is literally allow union representatives to approach workers and say, "Sign this card. We want to unionize here." Each employee's vote would be public record, so the employer could find out how they voted, the employees could find out who they voted, and the unions could find out how they voted. And you and I know that in any realistic situation, the unions would send heavies out there and be extremely intimidating in a one-on-one atmosphere and essentially use...
You think the employers are not doing that right now?
No, they don't do that right now.
First of all...
It's illegal to do that right now.
Well, as a matter of fact, the reality is that employees are fired in one quarter of organizing campaigns right now.
That is not true. What you have to
According to the Department of Labor, that's true.
No. Employees are fired all the time. The important question is, are they fired because they unionize or vote to unionize? And that is absolutely not true.
Okay. The UAW says 78% of private employers require supervisors to deliver anti-union messages to the workers whose jobs and pay they control. And even after workers successfully form a union, a third of the time, 30%, more than 33% of the time, the union can't get a contract.
No.
We have a very anti, and plus you said, right now, workers can, under the current National Labor Relations Board standards, they can ask for a secret ballot. But the way that they do that is by filling out, more than 50% of them, filling out a card. I mean, how is this different than signing a petition? I mean, right now, if I give money to a presidential campaign, that's a matter of public record.
Because I'm,
if I sign a petition that I want something on the ballot here, that's a matter of public record. What's wrong with this?
One question at a time here. That was a series of about three.
Sure.
First of all, you cannot fire somebody for voting for a union or engaging in union activity.
No, but what you can do is you can find a thousand little reasons to fire them.
Let me finish. That is simply not true. Those union statistics are lies. Anybody out there can look it up.
Listen, I have been an employer. I can tell you.
I let you go on for a while.
I'll let you go on for a while. We can have a back and forth here, Timothy. I'm really not trying to filibuster you. But I've been an employer. I know that if you want to get rid of somebody, you can find a way to do it.
You know what? You can do any number of things. And I've seen suit after suit after suit where an employee was fired for a legitimate reason. And what they do is they claim they were fired because they engaged in union activity. It is simply not true. Now, let's talk about the fact that supervisors can be required to pass out anti-union literature. Well, the union is going to pass out literature saying that they should be unionized.
Sure.
How is it the employer should not be able to pass out literature saying they should not unionize? The fact is, when people talk about jobs being shipped overseas, it's not because of China. It's not because of Mexico. A lot of times it's because these unions, and they insist upon things that make it completely cost ineffective to do these sorts of things.
No, you've laid a couple of points. First of all, I would say jobs are being shipped overseas because of the loss of the power of unions to control legislation.
That's not
unions,
true.
Unions supported protective tariffs, which kept American jobs in the United States.
Wrong.
As Reagan took apart unions, when Reagan came into office, 25% of the private workforce was unionized. Now it's down to about 8%. As the power of unions to protect work jobs in America went away, so did the jobs in America.
That is wrong. Unemployment now is lower than it was back then. Jobs are higher paying.
No, they're playing with the numbers. Read Kevin Phillips' piece in the current issue of Harper's Magazine.
I'm sorry, but you're absolutely incorrect, and anybody can look these up. These are
Bill Clinton numbers. Played with the numbers. Ronald Reagan played with the numbers. George Bush played with the numbers.
They have
redefined what unemployment means.
Unemployment. Below 5% now. It was much higher than 5% back then. You're simply wrong on that.
It is pushing 10%.
Wait, what?
It all depends on how you define unemployment. Not even the point. The point is we're talking about the good jobs going overseas. Okay, so, well, let's say that it's wonderful. We've got full employment, but my point would be that we don't have the kind of job. My dad worked in a tool and die shop for 40 years. He was able to raise four boys, put them through school. We had full insurance through that whole time. He did until the day he died. He had a pension. My mom is still getting that pension. He was able to pay off his house. Those jobs are gone. That was the American dream, the middle classes, and that is gone. And it's gone because unions are going.
No, they're gone. Well, they're gone because unions are here. Most of those jobs actually disappear because of automation, the same way that farming jobs disappeared 100 years ago. We do things more efficiently with machines. Can you let me finish? Productivity gains, mechanization, that's the main basis. We actually produce more through manufacturing, and you can look this up. America produces more through manufacturing today than they ever have. The fact is, most of those jobs disappear because of automation and productivity gains. But ask yourself this. Why are jobs shifting from Michigan to Alabama? The simple reason is because Michigan has much stronger union organizations. Alabama has weaker ones. Therefore, jobs go to Alabama. Jobs go to Sunbelt states.
They're shifting because of Taft-Hartley.
Unions kill jobs.
They're shifting because of Taft-Hartley.
No,
1947.
Taft-Hartley wouldn't have anything to do with shifting from the Rust Belt.
No, because Alabama is a right-to-work state. Michigan isn't.
Right, but that has nothing to do. What they're doing is they're saying we cannot employ people profitably when the unions do X, Y, and Z.
No, what they're saying is we can make more profit when we move to a place where we can get cheap labor.
No, or maybe they can't even survive if they stay in Michigan. It's a simple fact.
They were surviving fine for a long time. You know, worker productivity in the last 10 years is up.
Going out of business.
Worker productivity is up 22%. Real pay is down 1%.
No,
what's wrong with
true.
That equation?
That is not true. Real pay is not down in America, and that's another
Real
one
wages.
Of those ridiculous myths that go out there. Because what they do is they exclude benefits like health care. if you take those into consideration, overall compensation for
fewer people have health care now than when Bush came into office.
Say that again?
Fewer people as a percentage and in absolute numbers have health care right now than when Bush came into office.
That is simply not true. You've got to – people out there, for all the listeners out there, look this stuff up. Don't take my word for it. These are flat-out lies.
All right. CFIF.org is Timothy Lee's website. He's the Director of Legal and Public Affairs. Check it out. CFIF.org. Timothy, thanks for dropping by.
Thanks a lot. You have a good day.
And good talking with you. Interesting. Well, should we have unions? What's going on? Why is this huge effort being made to stop card check in its tracks? I'll tell you right after this.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the Teamsters. Uh-oh. One of those nasty unions fighting to stop the unfair trade deal with Colombia. Find out more at Teamster.org. Now, I'm telling you, there is this huge national organized effort. They bought a full-page ad in the Oregonian, which is our statewide newspaper here in Oregon. I'm sure the same thing has happened in newspapers all over the country right now. They're running ads on TV. And the reason why they're doing this is because the Democrats have said, and SEIU, the SEIU and the AFL-CIO, changed to WIN, actually. And the SEIU is one of the largest and fastest-growing unions in the United States, just to reduce it all down to one phrase. SEIU has said that come January, come the spring, they are going to organize millions of people to get the Employee Free Choice Act passed. And so the National Association of Manufacturers, the Chambers of Commerce of the United States, and other groups, both business groups, big corporations, manufacturing companies, and right-wing ideologues are pouring all this money into these groups. That unionfacts.org is one of them, the one that you see on TV. Employeefreedom.org is another. And, you know, basically saying, oh, my God, the Employee Free Choice Act is going to mean that you're going to have to sign a card and you can have a union. Well, right now, in order to have an election to have a union, you have to sign a card. 50% of the employees have to sign a card saying, yes, I'd like to have an election to have a union. Then the employer gets to force the employees to sit through anti-union meetings. This is a multi-billion dollar industry. That is to say, there are companies out there, consulting companies, that work with corporations that don't want to have unions, that are literally taking in billions of dollars in revenue. Busting unions in the United States has become a multi-billion dollar industry. What would the Employee Free Choice Act do? It basically has three components to it. Number one, it strengthens the penalties. See, right now it's illegal to intimidate or coerce employees not to join a union. But the fact of the matter is that it does happen, notwithstanding our guest's assertions that it doesn't. I'm sure he's absolutely right that there are cases where people simply claim that when really they were lousy employees. There are also people who have been fired because they were union. So number one, it strengthens the penalties for that. Well, companies are very concerned and worried about that. Number two, if there is a newly certified union, and if within 3 months they don't get a contract, because in many cases, even with the tortuous process right now of setting up a union in the workplace, where 50% of the people have to sign a card saying, yes, we'd like to have an election. And then the employer comes in and they give their speeches about how we're going to shut this union down. We're going to shut this place down if you guys have a union. And here's all the reasons why you don't want to have a union and blah, 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 blah. And then after that, if there's a vote and more than half of the people vote and say, yes, we want a union. So now you've got a union. More than a third of the time, within a year, there's not even a contract. So the Employee Free Choice Act says within 3 months, if you have a union, within 3 months, if you don't have a contract, we're going to bring in an independent arbitrator. The National Labor Relations Board is going to get involved, and we're going to, you know, help make a contract happen. And number three, it establishes majority sign-up. In other words, 50% of the people signing that card, yes, publicly signing that card, that right now calls for the election to be held, now it will mean that if 50% of the people sign the card and say, yes, we want a union, boom, you instantly have a union. It's that simple. And this has corporate America hysterical, absolutely hysterical. Now, think about the things that unions have brought us. The five-day work week, the result of union activity. The eight-hour day, the result of union activity. In the late 19th century, the 1800s, late 1800s, and the early 20th century, the early 1900s, late 1800s, early 1900s, it was not uncommon for people to work 10 hours a day, 6 or 7 days a week. It was not uncommon for people to work 12 and 14 hours a day. It was not uncommon for children to work. It was not uncommon for people to be sexually harassed in the workplace. It was not uncommon for women to be forced to have sex with their employers in the workplace. It was not uncommon for men to be fired because because of their political affiliation, because they were involved in union activity, whatever it may be. It was not uncommon for employers to hire companies to literally beat up or, in some cases, kill people who were trying to organize. In 1935, the Wagner Act was passed. Franklin Roosevelt pushed like crazy to get this thing passed. The National Labor Relations Act was passed, which created the legal right to have a union. And at its peak of the union movement, 1947, 35% of Americans were unionized. We went from virtually zero in 1935 to 1947, 35%. Then Taft-Hartley was passed, which said that a state could opt out of many of the provisions of the Wagner Act and become a so-called right-to-work state. In other words, you could have open shops or closed shops, and most of the southern states went along with that. Many of the northern states did not. And so it pitted one state against the other. And since 1947, union membership declined down to 25% under Reagan, and then Reagan declared war on unions, busting PATCO and saying, hey, this is going to be the new policy. The Labor Department is going to be hostile to labor, not friendly to labor, and we're going to help employers bust unions. And it's been that way ever since. We're down to 7 or 8% of the private workforce. Take your calls on this topic right after this break. 866-303-2270.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
6636 3220 34 minutes past the hour. We're going to be giving away a copy today of Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. Actually, this book that I wrote is just now out in paperback, and it's, in my opinion, the best book that I've written on economics, and I think you'll find it really interesting. Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. And Sean will be making a decision about her favorite post to today's show blog on the homepage at tomhartman.com, and at the end of the show, we will announce who is going to receive an autographed copy of Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. Crazy stuff going on out there. A Butler, Missouri car dealer said he's offering customers the choice of free gas or a free gun with a car purchase. Walter Morse, Max Motors, said the dealership is offering customers $250 in free gas or a free semi-automatic handgun. Well, most people are taking the gun. Why is that? Gee, I don't know. Maybe so you can stick up somebody and get some gas? That makes sense. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Doug in Battleground, Washington. Hey, Doug, what's on your mind?
Hey, I just wanted to call. Tim, I know you don't like to bash callers after they, or your guests after they left, but he's absolutely disingenuous about that. I was engaged in a union.
About what?
Well, the companies do fire people for organizing a union, and they're not even, they don't even hide it. They just do it, and then when you file an NLRB claim, they say, oh, well, we didn't do that, and it's up to you to prove that they did. And it's, I mean,
do you have personal experience with this, Doug?
Yeah, a little bit.
So tell us about it.
Well, I was organizing, I was trying to organize the truck drivers at a rock mining and ready mix outfit in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And things were going pretty good. We already had over half the people sign cards.
Mm-hmm.
And then
to get an election. Right.
To get an election.
Yeah.
You only need a third of the people to sign cards to get an election, but usually unions won't touch it unless you've got 65%.
Mm-hmm.
And we were working really hard at it, and then one day I get a message on our tattletale to told me to go drive to the Vancouver plant. I got there, and everyone's just looking at me, and they dragged me into this. Well, I mean, they didn't drag me, but they took me into a room with two retired police officers who proceeded to interrogate me for, it was about 8 hours after I'd already worked a 12-hour day. And then they called me and told me if I wanted to keep my job, I'd come back the next day at 10. And then they continued to interrogate me for about another 6 hours. And it was all on, some of the guys had talked about, some of the guys who weren't involved in the organizing had talked about a strike.
Hmm.
And it was all about that.
They were interrogating you about striking?
Yeah. And then, but they called it terrorist activity.
Oh, man. So this wasn't hey, we think you stole something from a construction site. This is about you, Doug, are a terrorist because you're talking to people about organizing a union which might lead to a strike.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
And then they fired you.
That's not even where it gets ugly, because they fired me that day, and then I still get mad about it. Then I filed an NLRB claim, and the NLRB was super.
This is the National Labor Relations Board. This is the federal agency that was created in 1935.
Yes, but they're super, you know, and so we filed a claim, and then the day after the claim was, or the day after NLRB served papers to the company I work for, I got served with a subpoena. They were suing me for some trumped up. It was facilitation of terrorism.
Amazing.
And amazing. So
as soon as you sued them, they countersued you to basically get you, I would assume, to get you to stop your legal action. You drop your suit, we'll drop ours kind of thing?
That's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
And so I ended up getting my own attorney. And you know,
which you had to pay for out of your pocket.
Yeah. Well, I had some savings, you know,
yeah.
This was a few
years
ago back,
yeah.
You know, and so I ended up out of my pocket defending myself and another guy. And it just, you know, I ended up prevailing, but it took, you know, it was 3 months.
Yeah.
I can't get a non-union job in Portland now. And not that I'd want one, but sometimes, you know.
That's incredible. Doug, I got to move along because I got a whole bunch of callers with a lot of stories here. But thank you for sharing your story with us. I very much appreciate the call. Well said. Dave in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Dave.
Yeah, hey, Tom. One of the smartest guys on the radio. I love you.
Thank you.
Hey, I was involved in union organizing in 2003, and your guest, he's full of it. This was over here at the Air Force Base in Dayton, and we was working for contractors. We knew that the current contractor was going to lose the contract with the government, so we decided to go ahead and we got with the Teamsters and we organized, and we done the card thing, and then we had the vote. Of course, the company we were working for at the time, they brought in all the people, you know, to sit down at the meetings and forced you to sit there and listen to their propaganda and everything about, you know, how bad unions were and everything. And we ended up getting the union in. We voted it in. I had to go before the National Labor Relations Board, and me and two other gentlemen, and testify against the company. We did, like I said, we did get the union in, and then the company that was losing the contract, they just refused to sit down with the Teamsters to negotiate a labor contract with us. Now, they were losing the government contract, but they just put us on total disregard for almost 6 months. Hmm. New company came in. They won the contract. They kept the old manager, who knew who all the union organizing people were, and we technically weren't fired, but
they just rehired all the non-union guys or the anti-union guys.
None of us were rehired.
Right. It's the old show.
And they drug their feet forever to sit down and negotiate with the Teamsters again.
Yeah.
Fortunately for me, we went to court and everything, and I never got my job back, which was a shame because I've been working that flight line for 10, 15 years. It was my home, but I never got my job back, but I got a very good settlement that the Teamsters got for me. And set me up where I am today, being a domestic engineer and staying at home and taking care of the house.
Okay. Dave, thanks a lot for the story. I appreciate it. Dale in Troy, New York. Hey, Dale.
Yeah, hi, Tom. How you doing?
Just fine.
I've been listening to you for about a year now, and it really, really expanded me. I'm one of those Teamsters. I work in the railroad industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I was listening to your guest earlier, and he did make the one point whereby some jobs are lost to automation. Currently for a major carrier that I'm with right now, some of that automation is costing guys jobs or getting guys set back. And, you know, I'm one of the guys who set back. But
the dock workers are seeing a lot of that, for example. But generally speaking in society, and this was a debate that we were having back in the 1950s, automation creates as many jobs as it loses. They're just different kinds of jobs, as long as it's all here. But when the automation is happening in China, you know, or in Mexico, then you can't argue that automation is creating jobs. You can argue that it's really taking away jobs.
Exactly, exactly, exactly. And, you know, and the one thing I've always found, too, is that when sometimes with this automation coming in, companies will never tell you their bottom line. I've gotten in arguments with guys who are saying that, well, if you do your job, there's no need for a union. Please. Please. You know, and just like you recited to him earlier, you know, back in, you know, early 1900s, with a lot of the physical violence and intimidation going on.
Oh, yeah, it's incredible.
It's just differently now. It's just
and the big difference, and again, I don't debate my guests when they're not here to defend themselves, I don't trash people when they're not around.
Right.
One of the points that was made in the discussion was if the union has the right to go around and talk to the employees, why shouldn't the employer have the right? Obviously, the employers have the right. They control the workplace. But
sure.
there's a significant difference between an employer and a union. And I say this both as a union member and as somebody who has been an employer for more than half of my working life. And
right.
And that is that employers are companies are basically kingdoms. They are not democratic institutions. Companies are hierarchies which can, you know, within certain legal restraints, by and large, operate on a whim. You know, it's like the old kingdom. The king can say, off with his head, or get him out of here, or whatever. Whereas
right.
unions are democracies. Unions represent the workers, but the workers elect the management of the union. And if the management doesn't go the way the union likes, that the workers want, then
yep.
they're out. And there's
they're
a
out.
Lot of stories in the history of labor of management yep. being out on their butt and all of a sudden the union making a U-turn or going in a completely different direction because
right.
the workers said, hey, enough already. We don't like this. We don't like
right.
the way it's going.
And, right. and, not working and, for the interest of the unionists.
That's right. Unions are Democrat. And thank you, Dale, for the call. Unions are democratic institutions. Unions are democracy in the workplace. If you believe in democracy, it's real simple. If you believe in democracy, then let's have democracy in the workplace. That is called a union. 45 minutes past the hour. TomHartmann.com for our live chat room, our blog, AirAmerica.com, 866-303-2270.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartmann Program. We'll be right back.
chain. Yeah, like the sound of the men working on the chain.
Yeah, now that's prison labor, but that, you know, in the old days, that used to be normal labor. By the way, I want to add, one of our callers, obviously somebody who's been listening to the program for a long time, you know, in the 6 years we've been doing this show, I don't, unlike many of the conservative shows, I don't trash my guests on the air or off the air, and I appreciate the fact that my listeners don't as well. And because I think it's really important, number one, that we have the dialogue, that we model how to have a discussion, and that we have opposing points of view. And because those, you know, Timothy Lee, for example, our guest, was putting out the point of view that's being put out by his side. And God bless him. I got to tell you, we contacted the people who ran the ad here in Oregon, and we contacted the union folk, the union facts.org folks. We contacted the companies that are advertising and this employeefreedom.org folks, and they were afraid to come on the program. They were just absolutely plain old flat out terrified, unwilling to come on the program, unwilling to defend their positions, although they are willing to spend millions of dollars on advertising. And so I want to give a tip of the hat, actually, to Timothy Lee from CFIF.org, because the Center for Individual Freedom, because he was willing to come on the program. And so anyhow, that said, we got a lot of calls and very little time, so let's try and make it really quick here. Rick in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Rick.
Hey, how you doing, man?
Great. What's up?
Hey, your buddy had me stressed out. The union guy? Or
yeah.
The anti-union
guy?
Yeah,
the anti-union guy.
Yeah, because, I try to think about the stipulations that you accept to have them come on. Because you could easily just squash what he's saying by simply saying that the U.S. government doesn't support sovereignty of labor anywhere on the planet. Nowhere.
Well,
Theoretically,
except in the United States. But you're right. In Iraq, we've maintained the rules that Saddam Hussein had put into place. He had a single union that are basically anti-union rules. That's you know, the Bush administration. Yeah, you've spot on, Rick. Well said. Thank you very much. Danny in Los Angeles. Hey, Danny.
Hi, Tom. I'm a union employee for an aerospace company. I don't know if I can say their name or not.
It's probably not a good idea.
Okay, and this is how they're destroying our union. What they do is they outsource the hourly union jobs to job sweatshops that are here in Los Angeles that are non-union and lower pay.
Right,
and
contractors.
And what they've done in a couple of cases is they've laid people off, and before the people have had their last day at work, they have them hired at the vendor.
Right.
And so it shifts the work from the on-site location to the vendor.
And this is the kind of thing that before Reagan got control of the NLRB, companies would have been prosecuted for. And it's just, it's absolutely wrong. And Danny, you're absolutely right. This is the kind of thing that, you know, back in the day when my dad worked in a union shop, just didn't happen in the United States. At least it didn't happen in Michigan, I'll tell you that for sure. Adam in Las Vegas. Hey, Adam. Adam, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. I listen to the show quite often, and I wanted to bring up a point about your call, the guy you had on the show, where he had said that, you know, jobs are moving down south. Well, my grandparents used to work in the mills down there, and they were unionized, and they all went away.
Yeah, good point. So it's not just that the union jobs are leaving Michigan and they're becoming lower paid non-union jobs down in Alabama, but that the old union jobs in Alabama, they're going away. Spot on, Adam. And I would submit to you that they probably went away after the Taft-Hartley Act was passed in 47. If there's anything that can be done to repeal the Taft-Hartley Act, that bill was passed. There were, you know, in the election of 46, the Republicans took control of both the House and the Senate, and Taft-Hartley was passed. Harry Truman vetoed it, and they overrode his veto. And we've been stuck with it ever since. Aaron in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Aaron.
Yeah, Tom, I really appreciate you giving me an opportunity to talk about this. I feel real strongly. I've had personal experience with this. I'm actually an organizer for a labor union. And what I really appreciate you addressing is the NLRB, while Timothy Lee was being technically correct, he was being deceptive. And then the fact that the NLRB and the act has been so weakened over time that it provides very little, if any, protection to any of the workers who try and organize. And you also tie this into the huge business growth of of union busting attorneys and analysts.
It is now spot on, Aaron. And in fact, we just got an email from the AFL-CIO here in Oregon, one of the folks listening. Tom Chamberlain is the president. He's on our show frequently, on our local show. $3 billion a year industry, busting unions. $3 billion a year industry. That's just the consultants who come in and help bust unions. Dave in Western Massachusetts, listening to WHMP. Hey, Dave. Dave, you're on the air.
Oh, great. Hey, Tom, great show today.
Thank you.
Generating a lot of buzz, aren't you?
your point, Dave.
Well, my sister works. She had an HR department at a local hospital, and she's constantly bumping up against the union there, and she and I have arguments continually. Her position is that unions merely support and protect lazy, no-good workers.
Yeah, which is unfortunate because it's not the case. And I can tell you, you know, having hung around a union shop through my childhood, that it's just not the case. Sure, you can find the exception to the rule. You can find examples of that, just like you can find examples of places where employers kept their brother-in-law on the job. But by and large, no, that's not the purpose of a union. Gary in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Gary.
Hey, Tom. I can't thank you enough for what you do. I started my family in the early 80s in Montana, and I was a single wage earner working in a lumber mill. I had no problem supporting my two newborn children, my wife, and myself. We had everything we wanted to do, we could do, and it just has disappeared in a whiff of smoke. And that's all they're doing is blowing smoke at us when they try to tell us anything different than real wages have declined. At least 30% over the last 20 years.
Yeah, real income actually has gone up because Bill Gates' income has gone up and Warren Buffett's income has gone up, and so much that when you average the very wealthiest, when you talk about wages, when you talk about paychecks, then real income has actually gone down continuously since the late 1970s. And it's lower now than it was when Ronald Reagan came into office. And all the more the tragedy, because productivity has gone up dramatically during that period of time. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, polar bears or gasoline?
Tom Hartman. Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The polar bear? Or ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson's $16.7 million annual compensation package, up 28%, by the way, from the previous year. William Eatman is with us. He's an energy policy analyst on the Energy and Global Warming team at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, their website. Prior to joining CEI, by the way, William was a Peace Corps volunteer in the, how do you pronounce that, Kyrgyzstan?
Kyrgyz Republic, yes, sir.
Kyrgyz Republic, where you taught into entrepreneurship and small business management to rural women, and you ran a homeless shelter in Denver, Colorado. Quite a background for a guy who's now with a conservative enterprise, a conservative think tank.
We're a free market think tank. I don't know if we're conservatives. We certainly have some people here who would consider themselves, in addition to being libertarians, conservatives.
Yeah.
But
it's amazing to me the number of people who, and I'm not speaking of you here, William, at all, but the number of people who are regulars on the show who 2, 3, 4 years ago would come on and go, I'm a conservative, I'm a Republican. And now they're saying, well, we're not really conservatives. I'm not a Republican, I'm an independent. It's like the winds are changing. Okay, well, here's the bottom line. The polar bear, Marlo Lewis, who's been on this program many times from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's a good guy. Just wrote this thing that basically by the Interior Department listing polar bears as an endangered species. And, of course, the reason for this is that they have one of the slowest reproductive rates of any mammals. Female typically will only produce 5 litters of 2 cubs in her entire life. And they need the sea ice in order to not just reproduce, but also to eat. And the sea ice is vanishing, apparently as a consequence of global warming. But nonetheless, your assertion, I guess, or your organization's assertion is that by listing them as an endangered species or protected species, that this is a backdoor way into cap and trade, or this is a way of preventing us from drilling in Anwar, or both? Do I get that right?
Oh, well, not just drilling in Anwar. I mean, that's an entirely separate issue, one that Congress will further debate and probably won't do anything on. But what it would do is set in process the regulatory workings that would ultimately require each federal permit, each time you need a federal permit. So if you're going to build an apartment building and you need a clean air permit, if you're going to build a new power plant and you're definitely going to need a permit, every single federal permit would have to take into account the effect of the object, of the desired object, be it building an apartment building.
Whether or not there's polar bears nearby?
That's exactly right, as to whether or not it affects the polar bear.
Well, what's wrong with that?
Well, we would say, that's a decision. What should we hold, and if Americans do want to proceed, if Americans want to hold the economy hostage, that's too strong a term, but if they want to
I'm sure it would go well on the Hannity economy
for the polar bear, then they ought to know as much. It ought not be this kind of backdoor regulatory mechanism by which we Americans only learn that they're being affected after the fact. So we would just want
to know. So how is protecting the polar bears going to harm our economy? I'm missing something here.
Well, what it would do is every single time, again, every single federal permit, if you list a species as endangered or threatened,
right?
For every single threat, by law, that basically...
You have to behave in a way that protects that species.
Exactly.
But you're assuming then that we're so stupid that we can't, we as a species ourselves, humans, I guess, or maybe just Americans, are so stupid that we can't figure out different or innovative or new ways to do things to accomplish our mission without destroying a species?
Oh, no, I would never say that Americans are stupid. I would never say that anyone's stupid.
Well, isn't that the subtext of the entire message here? Hey, you know, you got to either kill the polar bears or kill Rex Tillerson's $16 million paycheck. I mean, one or the other. Your choice.
It's not a choice like that. All we're saying is that if we proceed with this regulatory mechanism by which that would impact significantly the economy. Every single new apartment building, every single significant business, every single power plant, everything across the board that requires a federal permit would have to be judged in light of its effect upon the polar bear. Now, that's fine. If America wants that, that's okay, but let's just have it on the table.
I think America wants that. You know, William, I really think America wants, not just the polar bear, by the way. I don't see monarch butterflies anymore. And I remember as a kid, there were just zillions of them that used to come north every year. We're since 1960, and this is a study that just came out from I believe it was published by NASA, I may be wrong, but since 1960, a third, 30%, almost a third of all the animals on Earth have died, are gone. I mean, they've just like literally vanished. The human footprint is becoming so big as we approach 7 billion people and as we are belching out these mind-boggling amounts of not just carbon dioxide, but a whole variety of toxins and pollutions and waste. Our human footprint is becoming so big that we're edging out every other species on Earth, and we're interrelated with them. And I don't mean that in some kind of existential spiritual way, although that's real too. We're interrelated with them in as much as there's this web of life that is planet Earth that is incredibly complex and interconnected, just like all the cells and organs inside your body are. And if you go in and, I mean, you know, you can operate probably without one kidney and maybe with only one eye and maybe with only one arm or one leg, but at a certain point, you start taking out enough pieces of a complex biological system like your body or like the planet Earth, and the whole system collapses.
Well, I mean, I would suggest, I'm no scientist. I don't think, maybe you have a scientific background, I don't know, but I'm largely ignorant of the biological workings. I don't know necessarily.
I would submit to you this is common sense.
I don't know. I mean, we do have PhDs in biology. There are scientists in that field. I mean, it's not necessarily common sense.
Well, and the scientists are freaking out.
The
scientists, you know, Richard Leakey, one of the leading scientists in the world, just wrote a book called The Sixth Extinction. I mean, pointing out that if species are going extinct right now during this century, species are going extinct at a rate as fast as they did at the end of the Jurassic when the dinosaurs died out.
Did he attribute it all to rising emissions and rising temperatures?
But you can attribute it all to human activity, not to rising temperatures.
So it was all anthropogous, so humankind was the...
It's basically, we have reached the point where we're the single largest, human flesh is the single largest accumulation of single species biomass on Earth. It used to be termites.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and as a result, we're competing with every other life form on Earth for all the fresh water, for the air, for the food, for the products of photosynthesis, and the result is the other species can't compete. They're being wiped out. And I think that the polar bear is just another example of that. This is the proverbial tip of the iceberg to torture a pun here, metaphor. If we're willing to wipe out the polar bears, I mean, really what we're saying is we're willing to wipe out pretty much anything, because the polar bears are highly visible. There's all kind, the best guess from E.O. Wilson, the Harvard biologist, one of the top biologists in the world, is that we're losing 100 species a day to extinction right now, most of them species that have never even been cataloged. You know, fewer than 10% of all species alive on the planet have even been named right now.
Well, here's the deal. All right, I'm not a biologist. I'm not a population biologist. So the science of this issue, the impact upon the ecosystem, whatnot, this I'm ignorant of. But the policy, what do we do about it? If Americans do indeed agree with you, then how should we proceed? Should we proceed knowing what's on the table, knowing what we're getting into, or should we have bureaucrats in D.C. behind closed doors
answerable to we the people,
the entire economy on behalf, as the solution?
Okay, so if you want to get it down to that, then really the choice, the other half of that choice then is our choice is if the polar bears are at risk, then the choice is going to be made either by bureaucrats behind closed doors in Washington, D.C., who we can vote our elected representatives to fire or change the policies, or Rex Tillerson, the CEO at ExxonMobil, who, when I try to call him, will not take my calls, and if I keep calling, will have me thrown in jail for stalking.
Oh, man, he won't take our calls either. Excellent.
Right, but the point is, I mean, are we going to have, the kings of the kingdoms of industry making these decisions, or are we going to have people within government, which is we the people, that's us? I thought you guys believed in democracy making the decisions. Which is it going to be?
Mr. Hartman, you're twisting. That's not what I said at all.
But that's the choice.
Let me finish. All I'm saying is that instead of having bureaucrats decide this behind closed doors and then having Americans only know of it after the fact, after they try to start a small business, then they realize, oh, my gosh, I can't do this because of the polar bear. Instead of that, let's have our legislators, let's have our elected representatives decide in the public so that we all know what's up. That's all. That's all.
Well, I think that's what they're trying to do by creating the Endangered Species Act. I mean, isn't that what they did?
They did, but if you look at Kemp Thorne's, when he issued that, when he had this qualifying threat, he said specifically, and this is that all the legal analysts will agree, the Endangered Species Act was never designed to...
In other words, it's not working out that way. Okay. William, we're out of time, but William Yeatman, CEI.org, you can check it out. Thanks for coming on with us today.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
Now I might be old-fashioned, but I believe it's true that folks around the world are pretty much like me and you. I have a silly notion if we want them to be friends, they prefer that we don't torture them.
Oh, he's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
He's
yep.
a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
Unforgivable.
I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
He's your typical liberal.
Well, it looks like, speaking of liberals, Barack Obama, who, oddly enough, everybody on the right says is the most liberal senator in the United States. I would candidly disagree. I think that Russ Feingold has really, and Bernie Sanders, and although he's not a Democrat, and Barbara Boxer, and I think there are a number of senators, Ted Kennedy, who have been around long enough to have established a very, very solid liberal voting record, and one that, frankly, I think most Americans agree with and would be proud of. But it is time to change this stuff. I mean, the insanity of this administration. Julie McDonald, for example, this is emblematic. Just tying polar bears to the current presidential debate. Let me just try a segue here. And this month, Julie McDonald, she was the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks at the Interior Department. She said that industry positions should be equivalent to scientific studies when the Department the Interior was considering issues that had to do with fish, wildlife, and parks. She said that scientific studies are merely opinions, and, quote, we should treat them as we would treat an industry publication, end quote. She pushed biologists on her staff to give more serious consideration to industry positions, especially when the industry pushed for less regulation of a given species. And under McDonald, the Interior Department reversed a staff ruling on an endangered species of tree after the Air Force complained. I mean, she basically just said, okay, you don't want it. So we need to change this. How do we change this? By getting a Democrat in the White House. This is the executive branch of government. It's looking increasingly like Barack Obama, in all probability, will be the Democratic nominee. And I submit to you that Hillary Clinton is, and I may be wrong on this, but I don't think so. I think that she's pushing really hard for the VP slot at this point. And I think that it would be a ticket that could unify and heal the Democratic Party. As counterintuitive as that may sound, I know a lot of people have, I wrote the email for Air America yesterday, went out last night, I guess, essentially saying this, you know, Barack Obama, if Hillary doesn't want to be VP, you should still ask her publicly and let her say no. But I believe that she wants to be, and you know, I've had a lot of people say, nah, not a chance. Hillary Clinton doesn't want to be VP. She wouldn't take that position on the ticket. She wants to go back to the Senate. She should be offered the Supreme Court. I think if she goes back to the Senate, frankly, she should have Harry Reid's job. She should be the Senate Majority Leader. She knows how to take names and kick ass. That's a good thing. And Harry Reid doesn't do that. I mean, he's a good leader in a lot of ways, but he hasn't been the kind of out front, very public leader that the Democrats need, in my opinion. Or, you know, put her on the Supreme Court. But frankly, it is the presidency and the vice presidency that gets you into the history books. I mean, name one Supreme Court justice from the 19th century. Name five Supreme Court justices that you can remember from more than 20 years ago. Most people can't. Most people can't even name the current Supreme Court justices. You know, when Americans were polled 3 years ago about, you know, if they could name the Supreme Court justices or the Three Stooges, an overwhelming percentage of Americans, I forget the statistics, but it was 3-1 or 5-1 or something like that, more Americans could name Larry, Curly, and Moe than could name three members of the current sitting Supreme Court. So, you know, people say, oh, no, she doesn't want to be vice president. But vice presidents are remembered, and vice presidents get to run for president after 8 years. So I believe that what we're seeing here, this subtle shift in the Clinton campaign, and it's subtle, but it's visible. I believe that what we're seeing is that she is working toward the vice presidency. And I think that for political and healing purposes, for bringing this country together purposes, Barack Obama has to offer it to her. And therein lies that, you know, that Bobby Kennedy conundrum, the story. And depending on who you listen to, it's apocryphal or it's real, is that Kennedy's people had talked to LBJ, who was the leader. He had Harry Reid's job. He was the leader of the United States Senate, the grand old man from Texas, and or the bully curmudgeon, depending on which story of LBJ you want to carry. I mean, that's really how JFK viewed him. JFK did not like Lyndon Johnson. They were both senators and not good friends. But, you know, everybody knew that LBJ had presidential aspirations. And when Kennedy beat him in the primaries and became the nominee of the party, that Kennedy had people put out feelers to LBJ saying, hey, you know, would you like to be vice president? And his people had said, nah, he really doesn't want to be vice president. And they believed him. So Bobby goes to him and says, hey, you want to be vice president? Expect, you know, as a courtesy. And LBJ says, sure. And now they've got it. But it turned out to be a damn good ticket. It was a good team. And ultimately, LBJ, following Kennedy, I mean, tragically following Kennedy, but it might have been 8 years later by election, LBJ, with the exception of the Vietnam War, which was a god-awful tragedy, but setting that aside, which is, I realize, almost impossible to do, but nonetheless, in most other areas, certainly civil rights and poverty, LBJ proved to be a very good president.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Past the hour. Hey, just a quick heads up. Long-time listeners of the program know that back, about 8 years ago, I guess it was, I was invited along with about 30 other people, or more or less, to spend a week with His Holiness the Dalai Lama in at his home in Dharamsala, India. And McLeod Ganj, actually, is the next little town up where he lives. We spent the last day at his personal residence. And I took refuge from the Dalai Lama there. And that was made into a movie. And that movie is opening day after, not day after, it's opening tomorrow, Friday, in San Francisco. It's opening at the Roxy Theater. Roxy.com is the website for that, and I think it's just opening for one day. It'll be there tomorrow, and of course we're on the air in San Francisco, Green 960, and in Santa Fe, where we're on the air in KTRC, it's opening there at the Film Center at the Cinema Cafe, and that'll be Friday. So just a quick heads up, the movie is narrated by Harrison Ford, who is also in the Indiana Jones movie opening this weekend, and you will see me very briefly, but you will see me in the movie. And, in fact, the second voice that you will hear in the movie, the first is His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and the second voice is mine. So, it's an interesting movie about our trip to India to hang out with the Dalai Lama. 1-866-303-2270. We've covered a lot of territory today. Dennis on I-205. Hey, Dennis. What's up?
Hey, good morning, Tom. My family and I are in our diesel pickup truck with our fifth wheel making our first, possibly, only, and probably last trip this summer. Diesel just hit $5 a gallon in Clark County.
Wow.
410 at the Chevron at the fairgrounds. I hate to tell America this, but the true terrorists are not Osama bin Laden. The true terrorists are not Al-Sadr, Al-Qaeda, or anybody else. It's the oil companies that are going to change the landscape of this country and our way of life. The oil companies and our corrupt politicians.
Yeah, well, let me agree with you, Dennis, but slightly frame it differently. I would say that, yes, it's the oil companies, but it's the oil companies that back in 1978 and 79, when Jimmy Carter was working so hard to get legislation passed that would create a solar bank so that 20% of this nation's electricity would come from solar energy by the year 2000,
mm-hmm.
and that we would never again import more oil than we imported in 1977, when he was giving energy tax credits to individuals and businesses. Yeah, he was funding at the government level alternatives to oil, all these kind of things. The oil companies funded the Reagan campaign and funded Reagan. Reagan
sure.
came in and rolled all that back, which continued our addiction and our dependence upon oil, because I really do think that we are at Hubbard's peak. I think that we have reached the halfway point of the supply of oil in the world. We hit Hubbard's peak in the United States in 74. You recall, before 74, oil was in 25 cents a gasoline was 25 cents a gallon. And
yep.
and after Hubbard's peak, after we hit that midpoint, we started having to import in 73. We were importing oil, but we were exporting as much as we were importing. It had to do with which part of the country you were in. So basically, we were not a net importer of oil. After 74, the United States had to start importing oil because we couldn't
That's
produce
right.
enough for domestic production.
Tom, let me point another thing out. It's ludicrous that every one of these cars are on the freeway with me burning gasoline. There's a
yeah.
company in Norway making, it's called the Think Motor Company, making a viable electric commuter car that'll get on the freeway that was owned by Ford Motor Company until 1995. They've
yeah.
developed a viable electric car. This is not just the EV1. This has been going on for years.
Oh, the first cars were electric cars. I mean, back in 1901, back in the 1890s.
That's correct.
The first cars were electric cars, and Henry Ford's first car was an alcohol car.
That's right.
So.
Now, in closing, Tom, any Democrat in particular or American that votes for John McCain because his or her candidate did not get nominated on the other ticket is out of their bloody minds. And, Tom, I'm stocking up on canned goods, dry goods, and ammunition because the wheels are coming off this thing, man.
Yeah, Dennis, the canned goods and the dry goods, I'm with you there. On the ammunition, I'm not yet, but I'll tell you, my friend. Yeah, thank you. I don't think the country's going down in flames quite that fast. I think what we're going to see, though, is a massive adjustment and readjustment as a consequence of 30 years of Republican oil-driven policies. Gee, what a surprise. We've got two oil men as our president and vice president right now, and Condi Rice has a tanker named after her, and we're in this mess. And this mess is a mess that was created 30 years ago. It wasn't created last year, and it could have been solved. Claudia in L.A. Hey, Claudia.
Hi, I worked on the 11th Hour.
Oh, the movie. Hey, let everybody know, Leonardo DiCaprio's movie, The 11th Hour, is now out on CD, and they're charging $5 for it, as I recall. It's really inexpensive so that everybody can see it.
We did all the transcripts for it, and there was just so much in there that didn't get into the movie that was just all the typists that worked on it. Just
yeah, that's a wonderful movie, and I am so proud to be in that movie.
I just want to talk a little bit about another side of this polar bear situation, which the majority of Americans are not aware of, and that's a very powerful organization called the Safari Club International.
The what club?
The Safari Club International.
Oh, Safari. Okay.
Safari Club International is a trophy hunting organization, very powerful. George Bush and his father are honorary members. Also, James Baker was their keynote speaker at their convention a couple of years ago. This is an elitist organization that this administration and Cheney is also involved in it,
right.
Group of people are involved in, and they're very powerful, and their main goal, Brian Ross did a huge undercover investigation of them on Primetime Live about 2 years ago, and the more billionaires and the more millionaires that we get, the more people are involved in this, and they have a very strong influence in lobbying of the Endangered Species Act.
Right, because their main thing is to go out and shoot big animals, and many of the endangered species are the big animals.
Right, and it's a big competition, and all they care about is the competition.
Right.
And every year they publish a journal of who got the biggest and the best one, and they wanted to I don't know what the status is on that now, but they really wanted, they were lobbying very strong to hunt polar bears this year.
Right. Remarkable. Okay, Claudia, thank you very much for the tip on that. Matt in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Matt, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind, Matt?
Listen, I know this sounds really, really radical, but as long as we have become a fascist government, why don't we just nationalize the oil industry and get Bush and company out of all the business of oil? Because, I mean, literally, you're right. They are absolutely going to change the landscape of this country. They don't seem to care about our economy, and our economy is so oil-based. Obviously, we've got to do something and get out of it. I want an electric car so bad, and I'm going to wait until they come out. I'm going to buy one. But till then, I mean, let's be
humorous. I think you're going to see electric cars on the market in the United States within the next 24 months. And certainly you're going to see plug-in hybrids probably within the next 12 to 18 months. And, I mean, that's the direction things are going, Matt. And not only that, what you're going to see are charging stations of people's houses that now that solar panels are getting so cheap, where you put a roof on your garage and it becomes a charging station for your car. You put a battery in there and you plug your car in when you come in at night. I mean, all this stuff, I think we're going to be making these changes very rapidly. The problem is, and this is the tragedy of it, because it wasn't done proactive. See, this is how the free market works. The free market whacks people. The market will change this stuff. It will adjust. But it's going to devastate the lives of middle-income people, working people, and poor people. It's going to devastate them. Whereas if 30 years ago, when Jimmy Carter was proposing these kinds of changes and saying that this is what we had to do, if 30 years ago we had simply said, yes, this guy is right, we need to make these changes, we need to do these things, then poor people, middle income people, working people across the United States would not be being whacked by this. And it's just because we collectively would have said, no, we're going to do it right. We're going to fix this. We're going to set it up. We're going to do it right. And it is just such a tragedy, frankly, such a tragedy that I don't know how to say it beyond that. It's just such a tragedy that we have not allowed government to work, that the forces, basically, and I don't know how to call it beyond that, that, you know, the forces that call themselves the so-called free market are out there pushing this thing. This is Jimmy Carter, 1979, July 15th, 1979.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
And we wouldn't have if Reagan hadn't got elected.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
By the year 2000. Bring tears to your eyes? I mean, this is the kind of damage that the Republicans and the free market yahoos have wreaked, or wrecked, or whatever the word is, upon this nation. It is mind-boggling. Back to your calls right after this. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Listen to Jackson Brown all day. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And pretty much every Thursday, we try to get a local advertiser on who's had success advertising on Progressive Talk Radio as a way of both highlighting what they're up to, what they're doing, and also talking about, you know, the fact that this is a viable medium for advertising. Today, Lori Walters is with us. She's the acquisition director with Ironweed Films. Their website, ironweedfilms.com. Hey, Lori.
Hi.
Welcome to the program.
And thank you.
Our format is really simple and really short. It's, 2 minutes, a minute for you to plug your product and a minute to tell us about your experience of advertising and what station you're advertising on. So you can choose which you want to do first, and let me toss it to you.
Oh, okay. Well, I will say that advertising with Air America has been great. I mean, are you kidding? It's a dream come true. It's a match made in heaven, because Ironweed Film is like Air America.
So you're getting a strong response to your advertising?
Yeah, great. You sent out an email about us, we got a tremendous response to that. And if anyone is listening who missed it, again, they can go to ironweedfilms.com/AirAmerica, and you get two free DVDs for only $2.95.
Okay, so tell us about Ironweed Films.
So we're a progressive DVD club, like a Book of the Month club, only a DVD of the Month club, and you get to keep it. And we are specifically for progressives. We address all kinds of progressive concerns like you guys do, about the environment, politics, globalization, poverty. But this month, like you guys, we've focused a lot on the survival of democracy and this coming election. So this month, for instance, is really great, the May one, which will be over soon. So go and get it. It's all about America's flawed electoral process and the Supreme Court's role in it.
Is this the Call It Democracy?
Yeah, call it democracy.
That's great. Okay, Lori Walters, she's the acquisitions director with Ironweed Films, the website ironweedfilms.com. Lori, thanks for dropping by.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Great talking with you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. At 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, and David in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, David, what's up?
Yeah, hey, great to talk to you, Tom. Hey, I have one quick point and one quick question here. My point is, wouldn't it be my pipe dream, or I think everyone's pipe dream would be to have the oil companies go through an economic energy boom, as far as kind of like the bubble burst, kind of like the internet.com bubble bursting and the housing market, you know.
Well, I tell you, if the failure of not just the Reagan administration, but frankly, well, actually, Europe is pretty well positioned, and there are a number of countries that are getting energy independent quite quickly. But if the failure of the United States, since we consume a quarter of the planet's energy, if the failure of the United States under the Reagan administration is to prepare for this, leads to this, you know, $150 a barrel oil, $200 a barrel oil, which to some extent is an increase in the price of oil and to some extent is a reflection of the destruction of the dollar.
Yeah,
if that leads to an economic depression in the United States, it will burst that bubble.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be great, though, if the oil
It would be great if the oil companies got whacked. I think, you know, windfall profit tax is a more appropriate way to do it, though, than by inflicting another great depression on the American people.
Yeah,
what was your question?
It would be great if we were independent of oil and they had to appear before Congress
to
beg people for just subsidies.
It would. And we'll never be
question.
Independent, but because we still make plastics out of oil and things like that. Anyhow, your question was.
Yeah. One other question, Tom. What is the name of your movie? With the Dalai Lama.
It's called Harrison Ford narrates. It's called Dalai Lama Renaissance. I'm sorry if I didn't mention it. David,
thanks
a lot. Thank you. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Let's see. Gene in San Francisco. Hey, Gene, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You're playing that Jimmy Carter recording?
Yes.
And I wanted to ask and point out and see what you think of this. I think Jimmy Carter's effort to remake the energy sourcing for America, I think it failed because he didn't end the stranglehold on America caused by the oil trusts that were secretly created after World War II. The American oil companies, I think they were called the Big Five or whatever. I don't know what their nickname is now.
Yeah, there was the Seven Sisters, I think, at one point it was called.
Yeah, they convinced the Truman government that national security required the oil industry to be exempted from antitrust regulations. And, you know, during this last period where they had this short number of price gouging hearings, I think it was late last year or earlier, Arlen Specter mentioned that maybe we finally have to break the trust. And that was the last I heard of it.
Yeah.
And I truly think that was why Jimmy Carter failed, because the trusts are just exempted. There's no controls.
Well, I didn't know that, Gene. I knew about baseball, and I knew about the insurance industry.
Well, you have to. There's a wonderful documentary, The Prize, that was done in the early 90s, and they interviewed
I remember that book. I had that book.
Yeah, there's an individual that's interviewed, and he goes over this aspect of what happened at the end of World War II.
But I would submit to you that Jimmy Carter, it wasn't so much that Jimmy Carter failed, because I remember, you know, Vermont is a very, very cold northern state. And when Louise and I first moved to Vermont back in the early 90s, we were traveling around the state looking for a house to buy, you know, and we looked at, I don't know, 100 or more houses. And there were at least 5 or 10 houses that we saw that were completely off the grid, that were totally energy independent, or that were largely off the grid, that were largely energy independent. All of them were built in the late 70s because the Carter administration had passed those, you know, you could get a couple of $1,000 back on your income taxes if you built your home. If you were building, you know, contractors could get discounts. I mean, right across the board, there were all these rules in place to make energy efficiency a good and positive thing. And they were all rolled back by Reagan. I mean, he just undid them. Jimmy Carter had solar collectors on the roof of the White House. Reagan took them down. So I'm not sure I would say he failed. I would say that his efforts were thwarted.
Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
On Green 960 in San Francisco, and anybody within driving range, Thursday, May 29th at 7 p.m. And you can find this over at the website, green960.com. John Scott, who is a local personality there, and Angie Coro and I will be sitting down with a group of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton delegates. Actual delegates, people who will be going to the convention on behalf of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. And we're going to have a conversation. And we're going to see what will come out of it. And we're going to see if we can maybe... Well, we'll see. We'll see what, you know, can we have peace in the party? I think this is going to be fascinating. This is a week from tonight, 7 o'clock in San Francisco. It's $10 a person at the door. And you can check it out over at green960.com if you're in San Francisco. Has the nominee been decided? It looks like it. Is Hillary running for VP? Perhaps. I think so. Are Clinton supporters going to storm the convention? There are rumors of it. One of my colleagues has suggested that what's really going on is that Hillary is going to use the Rules Committee, that her campaign is going to use the Rules Committee in May 31st, at the end of May, this meeting where they're going to decide Florida and Michigan in such a way that it's going to have to be ratified by the delegates at large, which means the question of Michigan and Florida will still be in the air all the way to the convention, which means that the nominee won't be decided until the convention, which will buy her a few extra months to convince everybody that she should be the nominee. Plus, you know, there's still three more races to go, and she's can continue to make the claim, counting her votes in Michigan and the fact that Barack Obama was not on the ballot in Michigan, that she has more elected votes. There are others who are horrified by that. I disagree that that's what's going to happen, and I would be horrified, frankly, if that's what happens. And I think that would be very, very destructive to Hillary Clinton's campaign and to her and her husband's legacy in the party. I personally don't see that happening. But I can certainly see where some political strategists in her campaign may be arguing for that. So it's going to be an interesting one. It's going to be a very interesting one. So an awful lot of stuff on the table today. We've talked about unemployment and unions and polar bears and Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and the future of the Democratic Party. 1-866-303-2270. We'll take your calls here throughout this half hour. And then at the bottom of the hour, Christy Harvey's going to drop by from the Center for American Progress with the best of the rest of the news, that things that might have slid under the radar. Marty, speaking of San Francisco, Marty in San Francisco, listening to Green 960. What's up?
Hi. Well, I've got two things. First one is, in the first hour, you had a discussion with a guy about the nation's unemployment numbers, and he was talking about how accurate they are.
Right.
I do a lot of reading in the financial papers, and one of the things about the unemployment numbers is they are really flaky. Some of them are just add in numbers. And I have an example. In the last unemployment numbers they came up, they add about 246,000 jobs to the new job total to cover, quote, jobs that come from companies that started up since the last time they measured it. So they have
right.
no idea. They just pull this number right out of the hat and
right.
add it in.
This is the entrepreneurial assumption.
That's an assumption. It's just, right. and a lot of times these numbers are model generated.
Yeah.
They're very suspicious.
Well, and not only that, they no longer count people who, it used to be they didn't count people who'd been out of work 4 years. Then it became they didn't count people who'd been out of work 1 year. Now I believe they don't count people who no longer draw unemployment compensation. They used to count people who were working part time but not working full time as unemployed or seeking jobs. Now they count them as employed. There have been so many changes. As I said, Kevin Phillips lays all this stuff out. We did a whole show about it. I think it was on Monday of this week. Kevin Phillips lays it out brilliantly in the current issue of Harper's. So well said, Marty. Thank you very much. Appreciate the call. Mark in Miami, Florida, listening on Winds 960. Hey,
good afternoon.
Mark, what's up? Hey.
I really enjoy your show every afternoon here at my office.
Thank you. And we're very, very grateful to be on the air there in Miami on Winds.
Yeah,
what's up?
Yeah. Well, I know that you've spent a little time studying Cuba and some of the events in Cuba, and I've read your book on the related Kennedy assassination and the debunking of the Cuba myth.
Mm-hmm.
But your comment, I can't remember if it was yesterday or the day before, that anyone who speaks out against the regime is jailed. And I have to be...
That is far too sweeping a statement.
Yes, that was very overly sweeping, because there is an indigenous and a homegrown opposition and dissident movement in Cuba, and one that is not funded by the United States. And I just wanted to get your reaction on some of these new revelations that Ms. Beatrice Roque, Marta Beatrice Roque, and some of the ladies in white and some of these 75 so-called journalists, independent journalists who were jailed, had been receiving money from Miami-based terrorist organizations that were started up by Luis Posada, Santiago Alvarez, Orlando Bosch, and Alpha 66 in Miami.
Right. And so, therefore, from the point of view of the people who are speaking on behalf of the Castro regime, for lack of a better way to say it, the people who are put in prison for speaking out are not put in prison for speaking out. They're just put in prison for agitating on behalf of terrorist organizations and advocating the overthrow of the government, which in the United States is also a crime.
Yes, it is.
And
they're aiding and abetting the declared enemies of Cuba.
Right. And on the other hand, I've heard from a number of people, and we have some a couple of friends, including an old college roommate of mine and an old girlfriend of mine who have been married now for 30 years, who go to Cuba regularly, who say that, you know, you talk to the average person on the street and they will tell you what they don't like about Cuba and Castro and the whole bit. I mean, people are not at all reluctant to speak out.
Yes.
And, you know, so it's, I think the situation is far more complex than people on either side have tried to characterize or caricature it as. And I'd love to get down there and check it out myself.
Well, I can recommend a fantastic book for you and your audience if you're interested in
sure.
the electoral process in Cuba. It's a book written by Professor Arnold August of McGill University.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Democracy in Cuba, and it's the study of the 1997-1998 election season in Cuba, where he does a thoroughly independent, not government-guided or no minders or anything like that. He has free rein to travel around Cuba and observe the rather lengthy election season that they have there with their three levels of assemblies and parliaments.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a fascinating read, Tom, and I think that you should give it a perusal, because
I will check it out.
It's not a single party system in Cuba. It's like a non-party system. There are multiple parties, but no party in Cuba does nominations or campaigning for any particular candidate.
Mark, I'll check it out. And thank you very much for the call, and thanks for listening there in Miami. Frank in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Frank.
Yeah, how you doing? You know, these MBA graduates who've never had a job in their life are getting these executive positions with corporations and making hundreds of thousands, or if not millions of dollars a year. And, you know, corporations have no loyalty except to their executives who vote themselves huge bonuses, you know, like in the $7 billion case, what was it, McGuire?
Yeah, William McGuire of United Healthcare. $1.78 billion over a 10-year period. That's mind-boggling.
So, I mean, it's not only as obscene, but, you know...
And that came out of our pockets. I mean, this is a health insurance company.
Yeah, no, that's why they deny you benefits, because they're paying their executives huge amounts of money.
There you go.
A friend of mine, you know, they have no loyalty, like I say. He built up a territory, and the corporation said, well, we could hire three people for what he's making. And when he went to his job in the morning, the security guard said, you're terminated. You know, and he said, well, let me get my things from the desk. He says, no, I'll bring them out to you. And he threw everything in a cardboard box and handed it to him.
Yeah.
But so the subsequent story about this was the three people that they hired to replace him couldn't replace him.
Yeah.
That's
there's a lot to be said for experience. No, I have heard and seen stories like that myself in the job, you know, in the labor market in the last 20 years where particularly older, more experienced and more well-paid employees are replaced because there are people and in part because also their health insurance is more expensive, but mostly because they've been around long enough to have gotten the bonuses and the raises over the years that they, you know, whereas you can bring in somebody who's fresh into the job market who will do the job for half the pay. Hey, why not? And so people just get bounced out, and it is the progressive destruction of the middle class in America. That's the bottom line. That's what's going on. 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's 21 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters fighting to stop the unfair trade deal with Columbia. Find out more at Teamster.org. Don in Northern New Jersey on the line. Hey, Don, what's up?
All right, Tom, yeah. I wanted to ask you about, I'll ask you what you think. I think that I'm a Barack Obama supporter, but I believe that Hillary Clinton will not only win the Democratic nomination, but will become president. And I'll tell you why. Her husband, Bill Clinton, became a member of the Bilderberg group 1 year before he became president. And he was elected.
And therefore,
Hillary is presently a member of the Bilderberg group.
Yeah, she also eats mashed potatoes. I mean, that kind of logic is like, hey, I guarantee you 100% of all serial killers drink milk.
Okay.
So we should outlaw milk, and in fact, we should track down everybody who drinks milk and put them in prison.
No, well, I'm not saying
you're confusing cause with effect, Don. You know, it's becoming a member of a, you know, this is what the conservatives go off about the Council on Foreign Relations. Oh my God, look at it. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He must be an internationalist. Well, no, it's kind of a, you know, a club for people who are interested in issues that have to do with international relations. It's just not that simple. I'm sorry. It's not like there's some little puppet conspiracy controlling the world. The conspiracy is right out in the open. All you have to do is look. It's called the World Trade Organization, NAFTA, all this stuff. It's called transnational corporations, corporate personhood. It is obvious for anybody. You don't need a secret society to rule the world. You just need the cash. And you know, there's a bunch of them that have it. Fortunately, in the few democracies around the world, you need the will of the people with you. And that's why I suspect that what's going to happen, it certainly seems to be in the United States, that the will of the people is moving in the direction of Barack Obama rather than Hillary Clinton, although she has a lot of, you know, both of them have a lot of supporters, and I think we just have to acknowledge, you know, both of those. Tony in Orange County, California. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
By the way, great show. Tom, I was listening to Rush Limbaugh earlier, and I apologize to all your listeners for that.
That's okay.
But he actually, you know, he was coming up with this whole Operation Chaos and telling people, his Republicans, to vote for, you know, for Hillary to keep her in the race, I guess, to continue disrupting, you know, the election process. And now, today in the morning, he was actually reaching out to all the women voters, all the Democratic women voters, saying that the Democratic Party has basically shunned them.
Tony, the bottom line is that, I think this is one of the reasons why I beat Limbaugh on the ratings in two cities now, in three different Arbitron rating books. is that, you know, he's just reaching out increasingly desperately to get his name in the press and to get PR and to get, you know, the guy is not relevant anymore. Right-wing talk radio is increasingly not relevant anymore. America's moved beyond that. America's moved beyond, you know, hate and fear-mongering and finger-pointing and you know, really wants to talk about some of the issues facing us, like the destruction of the American middle class. Right-wing talk radio will never go near that. Because that's their baby. I mean, that's their, it's their product. Thanks a lot for the call, though. Greg in Cucamonga. Hey, Greg.
Oh, hello. You were talking about unions a while ago. And
yep.
Guy made a remark about unions protect the lazy, no good workers. And you kind of just kind of.
Well, I said sometimes it happens, but, you know, it's.
I'll tell
it's
you,
like,
that's a big ongoing issue right now. It happens all the time with my wife. I'm pro union. I worked 16 years in a paper mill, and my wife right now, she's a union rep, and they waste her time protecting these golf laws. And, you know, the union workers don't realize what a good deal they have.
See, the bottom line, like the problem here, Greg, is that
place and they abuse attendance and all types of.
No, I understand that, and the bottom line is that there's a weakness to the power of a union, and that's the weakness that you've just identified, and that is the ability to abuse it to protect people who are not working hard. On the other hand, there's a weakness to there not being a union, which is that the employer then can abuse it and abuse their employees. And frankly, I would say that the greater harm comes from there not being a union than there being a union. And not just greater by, you know, 51 to 49, greater 90 to 10. You know, as I said, my dad worked in a union shop his whole entire life. And I used to, after school, elementary school, I used to walk down there and hang out in the tool and die shop for hours with these guys. They worked hard, you know, and union guys, they worked hard. It took a lot to become a journeyman tool and die maker. I have a lot of respect for unions in this country. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-302-2270. Foghorn blows, I will be coming home. Yeah, when the foghorn blows, I want to hear it. I don't have to fear that I want to rock your gypsy soul. Just like way back the days of old, and magnificently we will fold until the misting.
And Sean Taylor, our producer, is right now going through, well, she'll continue to for the next 15 minutes or so, going through the posts on our blog at tomhartman.com for her favorite post of the day, who will receive an autographed copy of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. So, anyhow, Christy Harvey is with us. She is the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress and editor of MikeCheckRadio.org, AmericanProgress.org, of course. Hey, Christy.
Hey, how are you?
I am great, and great to have you with us.
I was a little bit grouchy today. I'm just having one of those grouchy days, and now I'm all mellow and happy with the Van Morrison. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Van Morrison does that to me,
suddenly.
Too. Yeah. So Henry Waxman, the mustache of justice, I have some of this audio here. Take one, two, three, and four. I think the third attempt was the most interesting one.
Okay.
Shall we try that?
It seems to me you're being awfully evasive, and I don't know why you cannot tell this committee whether you in fact had a discussion about this rule or that rule or the other rule. We're only talking about three different rules. Either you did or you didn't. And I don't know why you cannot tell us that information. No one is asking you what was said. We're just asking you whether you had a conversation. And the answer is not acceptable to say, I've had conversations with the president and others on a routine basis, and I'm not going to tell you whether I had a conversation on these subjects. What else do you talk to them about?
Now, that was Waxman. Here's Johnson's response.
As I said, I have routine conversations on
a wide range of topics. In those routine conversations, did you talk about the ozone?
I have never really wanted to play a drinking game while watching C-SPAN like I did during this hearing because
right.
Henry Waxman, of course, is talking to the head of the EPA, Stephen Johnson, about whether or not he met with the White House to talk about these dreadful ozone regulations they just put into place or the California, the refusal to grant California its waiver on its emission standards. And so he kept asking him, did you meet with the White House? There's rumors you met with the White House about this. Everyone's saying this. Did you? And every single time, Stephen Johnson said, it was robotic almost. He'd memorized one answer.
Right.
I've had regular routine conversations with members of the White House on a variety of topics.
Now, is he lying or weaseling or waffling or whatever he's doing here? Because if he had had conversations with the White House specifically about this and they had made these decisions based on politics rather than science, as the head of the EPA, he would be violating what would in the corporate world be called fiduciary responsibility. I'm not sure what it's called in the governmental world. And therefore breaking some rule or law? Or is he simply doing this because he doesn't want it to look like they're playing politics with the EPA?
Well, it's definitely unethical. You know, and
criminally unethical?
I don't know if it's criminally unethical, but I think that it could be a pretty big deal. You know, he's basically turned into the EPA's Alberto Gonzalez, where he has played hardcore politics with his office, trashed his agency, all for the White House with and there's a secret meetings out the wazoo that he's had with people at the White House.
Right.
And then when he's been busted on it, we just found out late last week that people came forward and said that Stephen Johnson had been for granting California's emission standards and then got an emergency call from the White House, went and met with them. He came out and said, actually, we're going to deny it now.
Right.
And so, you know, that, and he went against his, we know this, he went against his own scientists. So what Henry Waxman is trying to do, he's trying to use his mustache of justice for good, not evil, and figure out exactly what the White House did to try to manipulate these agencies. And I think, actually, the White House stands to get in more trouble than Stephen Johnson would.
Right, but he's got to protect the White House, otherwise they're not there to protect him.
Exactly.
Or to employ him, or, you know, whatever, to advance his. And these guys are just, I mean, you know, we have 242 days, 10 hours, 12 minutes, 8 seconds. Oh, boy, it's counting down until George W. Bush.
That seems practically doable. I think they'll make it.
Yeah, they're just going to try and run out the clock is what they're doing. And not a good thing. Gitmo, by the way, let's talk about this.
Oh, man. This was pretty crazy. Rear Admiral Mark Busby, that's difficult to say three times fast. He's one of the commanders of the Joint Task Force at Guantanamo, and he had a conference call this week to talk to bloggers, to talk to them about all of the allegations that there's torture and abuse and mistreatment of detainees at Guantanamo.
Right.
And he actually said, I am not making this up, he actually said that the living situation in Guantanamo is basically the same as living in a frat house.
Yeah.
It's the same as a fraternity.
In fact, here's the transcript. One of the bloggers asked about solitary confinement, and he said, we don't have any solitary confinement down here in Guantanamo. What we have is single cells. I mean, there's one person to a cell. All the cells are right next to each other, which is solitary confinement, right? That's like having a single apartment in a fraternity house, suggested the blogger, to which Busby responded, pretty much.
Exactly. And then he went on and he did explain a little more, and he said, look, these quote-unquote fraternity apartments, they're the same conditions that the U.S. Bureau of Prisons uses for prisoners. And he made that sound, you know, like it's very normal. It's just like the prisons on the mainland.
Right.
And here's the thing, though. He was referring to these supermax prisons in which they do have these single cells that legally can only be used on a very temporary basis for the worst of the worst.
Right, because solitary confinement like this over time produces insanity.
Exactly.
It destroys people mentally.
It does. It does. And not only that, but it will distort any testimony that we could be, you know, learning from these people. And then, you know, we've got all of these people that we've kept in these conditions –
And then when we realize that we don't really have anything on them, let them go. And what we've really done is turn them into people who hate us.
Right.
And people whose minds have been destroyed, which just doesn't seem to make any logical sense to me.
Right. Plus it violates the, what is it, the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment? I think it's the Eighth.
I think you're right.
Either six, seven, or eight. One
Sounds
of those
right.
three.
And they asked Robert Gates about this week. I think it was yesterday or the day before, and he was testifying in front of Congress about the supplemental bill, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, so what about Guantanamo Bay? You know, you've said that you think we should close it. The president has even said that we should close it. And Gates could only basically shrug his shoulders, and his direct quote was, well, we're stuck with it.
Yeah.
We're stuck with it. Not we're working to figure it out, we're working to reabide by international law, but we're stuck with it.
Well, the problem is if they let people out and they let them have fair legal proceedings, they're going to discover that some number of them, whether it's just one or two or whether it's 50 or 100 or whatever it may be, absolutely shouldn't be there, which means that we've got some serious liability. The ones who should be there were treated in ways that are violations of international law. I mean, basically, what's going to come out is that we've broken both international treaties, we've violated the Nuremberg Principles, we've violated the Hague, the Conventions on Human Rights, and we violated American law.
Well, exactly. And much like we were just talking about with the EPA and Stephen Johnson, it's one thing for these rumors to be flying around the globe about all of the mistreatment and torture and things, and it's another for there to be proof that would come out should we let any of these people go. So it's just,
right.
It's a nasty, nasty situation.
Yeah. Everybody loves to talk about sex. I guess Washington, D.C. is all agog about it, too.
Yeah, there have been a couple of new things. First, do you remember Dusty Fogo?
The number three guy at the CIA.
Exactly, and he was totally into that whole Duke Cunningham bribery.
It's Fogo, though, huh? I always thought it was Fogo.
Maybe it is Fogo.
I mean, I said it that way just because I thought, he's foggy, you know, it's a CIA. Yeah, right, makes sense. Okay. So,
well,
anyhow, Dusty
there's
Fogo.
A brand new indictment against Mr. Dusty. We'll just call him Dusty F.
Yeah.
We knew that he had been doing some money laundering for Duke Cunningham with all of the defense contractor bribery scandals.
Right.
But now it turns out he was indicted this week for taking bribes himself, quote, in the form of sexual companionship and the enrichment of a mistress. I'm not even quite sure what that means, but I think he took hooker bribes is basically what happened.
Yeah. Amazing.
And We'd heard that Duke Cunningham and his buddies had basically hooker parties on a boat down near the Watergate.
Right.
But this is one of the first times that Dusty himself has been indicted technically on these issues.
Amazing. We were talking in the second hour of our program about the polar bear. In fact, our question for the hour was, which should we save, the polar bear or ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson's $16.7 million compensation package? And we had a conservative on saying that we should save Mr. Tillerson's compensation packet. Well, he didn't say that. But, I mean, taking the position we'd need to think about our economy before
right.
we think about the polar bears. Alaska, the state of Alaska is weighing in on this?
Yeah, their Republican governor, Sarah Palin, is coming down on the side of your listener friend there. She's going to have the state sue the U.S. government to stop the listing of the polar bear on the endangered species list because she said that it could hurt the oil companies who want to take the polar bear land and, you know, build stuff on it.
Yeah.
So she has made the same decision, and she's decided to throw her lot in with the oil companies, and who can blame her? You know, the polar bears don't really give a whole lot of campaign contributions.
Yeah. Interesting. By the way, the House Judiciary Committee just issued a subpoena for Karl Rove in the Don Siegelman case.
Interesting.
Yeah. We'll see how that one plays out. It'll probably be another one where they're trying to beat the clock. Christy Harvey, the Director of Strategic Communications, Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, MikeCheckRadio.org. Thank you, Christy.
Thanks, Tom.
45 minutes past.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Everyone believes emptiness to everyone.
7.5 minutes before the hour of the Tom Hartman program. And Sean Taylor, our executive producer, has been going through our posts today at TomHartman.com on the show blog and has come up with her favorite. And what is that, Sean?
It is from AutoMine today, and it says, if there are so many manufacturing jobs in America, why can't I find a pair of sandals that say Made in America? Help, Tom, you give us sanity every day. Thanks.
Ah, that's sweet. And so once again, our winner is?
AutoMine.
Good on you, Otto. And Otto will receive an autographed copy of Screw, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, and what we can do about it. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you, Tom.
And now Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, is with us. And hey, Ellen, great to have you back. I still have the image of you sitting in the seat where Sean is sitting right now when you were live with us 2 days ago.
Well, I wish I was still there.
It was wonderful having you here.
Where it's cold right now. So I normally do not start out the show or at any point really trying to get into the Obama-Hillary thing. Just because, it's like quicksand. But I do have to talk about a few things that happened today that were really quite amazing. And first of all, Nancy Pelosi did her weekly press conference today.
Mm-hmm.
And, she said when asked about the fact that Obama may be looking for a VP selection, she said that Obama and Clinton have a good chance to become the nominee, and that she isn't giving advice on the VP selection. And actually, that audio will be on our website in just a few minutes. So that was really – she has not said anything like that before, at least recently. And then –
Now, what how do you read this? What's the significance of this in your mind, Ellen?
Well, it's either two things. She's either playing it extremely safe, or she believes that in terms of just not alienating anybody in the party as Speaker of the House, or she really knows something about their tactics on the Clinton side that may give her the nomination. And I don't know how to read it. I'm just putting it out there. But I do know that Harold Ickes also and Howard Wolfson had a conference call today, which one of our staffers was on. And he said that the campaign believes that all delegates from both states should be seated, that is Florida and Michigan, and have a full vote. He said of the 55 uncommitted delegates from Michigan, he said all should be seated as uncommitted delegates, and he hopes that this will be resolved in the Clinton campaign's favor on May 31st. And then he was asked why the Senator Clinton's position seemed to be that states could break the rules of the party with real consequences. He said that the intention of excluding Florida and Michigan was to send a message to other states that there would be severe consequences if they did not comply. He said that goal was accomplished since no other states broke the rules.
But if you reward bad behavior, you can't argue that you've achieved that. Although, you know, the bottom line is ultimately Michigan and Florida, I would say, have been punished, as it were. They didn't have all the advertising dollars in their states, which really was their goal in moving up their primaries. I think that even more than influence was to bring the candidates and the revenue that comes with them into the states. But how does this, I mean, you know, there's this theory that she's going to use the Rules Committee, she's going to get the rules set up in the Rules Committee on the 31st of May in such a way that it's going to have to go to the convention to be ratified by the delegates. And therefore, she keeps this thing running till the convention, and then she might be able to twist enough arms or win enough votes.
That's exactly what I think the theory is that she will be doing.
This is sometimes referred to as Clinton's nuclear option.
That's right.
Yeah. And I just can't imagine her doing that. I would think the blowback would be so incredible. You think it's possible?
I think it's not only possible. I would have been where you were at maybe 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And not only do I think it's possible, I think it's probable at this point.
Wow.
Now, I'm a bad predictor. I've called every election wrong, but I don't know. I sit here with, you know, my gut feeling, and the problem is, and another thing that happened today, George Washington University did a conference call on the battleground poll that they did. They had a Republican pollster from the Terrence Group. They had Celine from Lake Research, and she said that there's no question that McCain is a formidable candidate. However, she said Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama is overwhelmingly winning over independent voters compared to McCain. That's sort of an interesting piece as well.
Well, we saw that in many of the primaries. I won't say all or most of them, but in many of the primaries, we saw Obama picking up a lot of independents. I think, although Hillary Clinton was picking up a lot of independents, too, I think the independent vote this year is going to go Democratic unless we really screw this thing up badly.
Well, yeah, that could be very doable. President quickly just gave a speech today at Fort Bragg where he laid out the definition of success in Iraq, and he said
again?
Success will. Yes, he never stops.
Right. Okay.
He said, and by the way, Petraeus at his hearing sort of echoed exactly what the president said. He said, it will be, when Al Qaeda has no safe havens in Iraq, and Iraqis can protect themselves, and then when Iraq is a nation that can support itself economically, well, it must be supporting itself economically because they just agreed to buy $3 billion worth of arms from the United States.
Right. The big U.S. defense contractors are making out very well. Thank you very much. And by those definitions, Iraq was a success before we invaded.
I guess so.
No, there was no Al-Qaeda there. It's amazing. Ellen Radner, the Talk Radio News Service.
I love the way you put that.
Yeah, talkradionews.com. Thank you so much, Ellen.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, Senator Bernie Sanders drops by for our weekly brunch with Bernie. Your chance to get your calls taken by a real United States senator. And, of course, Anything Goes Friday. You choose the topic and we'll talk about it. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Participate in our democracy. Give your congressmen, your senators a call. Join, show up for the Democratic Party. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.